ربنا ومن سيئات أعمالنا، من يهده الله فلا مضل له ومن يضلل فلا هادي له، وأشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وحده لا شريك له، وأشهد أن محمدا عبده ورسوله. All praise be to Allah, and as such we should praise Him, seek His help, seek His forgiveness, and seek refuge in Him from the evil which is within ourselves and the evil which results from our deeds. For whomsoever Allah has guided, none can misguide, and whomsoever Allah has allowed to go astray, none can guide. And I bear witness that there is no God worthy of worship but Allah, and that Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam is the last messenger of Allah. From the previous session where we were looking at different Islamic issues, we looked at the cliche, Islam spread by the sword, was it spread by the sword? And we looked at the rationale for polygamy, as well as arranged marriages, child marriages, and the permission which is given to Muslim males to marry non-Muslim females, and the fact that Muslim females are only allowed to marry Muslim males. In this session we'll be continuing to look at issues concerning women. We'll be looking at the issues of hijab, the veiling of the Muslim woman. Is it a symbol of oppression? We'll also be looking at the right to divorce. Is it something restricted to males or not? And women's rights with regards to witnessing crimes, etc., and contracts, as well as their rights with regards to the inheritance laws. And these are all areas which those who seek to paint a negative image of Islam like to focus on as areas wherein there is evidence or appears to be evidence that women are oppressed. That is, Muslim women are oppressed. And from our previous talk, we pointed out that in general, the mistakes which come up in understanding the position of women in Islam with regards to various laws, legal systems, is that there is a tendency to want to look at Muslim women in the light of Western society, where Western society has taken certain direction, the family relationships are in a particular form, then to try to look at the Muslim woman within this context obviously is going to create a distorted image. And what we invite people to in general is to look at the Muslim woman within the context of Islamic teachings. But we did point out that in Muslim countries, among Muslim peoples, one may find Muslims oppressing women, their women. And this has to do with the culture of those particular areas, and not to do with the teachings of Islam in particular. So, with regards to the veiling of the Muslim woman, first and foremost, what we find is that in this society, historically, women have been in a position of weakness, meaning that they are subject to harm in society. This is real. And there is a direct relationship between the attacks on women, the molestation of women over the last 100 years, and the removal of clothes from women during that same period. If we look at Western women at the turn of the century, we would see them dressed virtually like Muslim women, covered head to toe. And today we look at the Western woman as portrayed to the world as a whole, you know, which has become sort of the standard for dress. This woman is virtually naked. In the United States, in 1991, the figures released with regards to the molestation of women was that the amount of rapes which took place in America in 1991 had crossed the 100,000 mark. This is 100,000 rapes. This is those that have been reported. Those reported. And they estimate that those which were not reported, because for a variety of different reasons, women may fear to report this, they estimate that it would be someplace between 7 and 10 times that amount. So we're looking at an attack on women on a scale which is unimaginable. When you try to bring that down to a daily rate, I mean, you're talking about something which is incredible. Of course, to some degree, some people argue, well, the reason why there's so many now is because people are reporting them. Maybe, 90 years ago, 80 years ago, they weren't reporting them. Okay, yes, to some degree, you know, people are more open to talk about these things, so that will account for a certain amount of the reports. But the police reports, which have to do with criminal cases where people are attacked and they are found, or the reports get directly to the police files when they're coming in direct contact, the amount of rape that they are recording is still greater. I mean, there is, without a doubt, when we look at all the statistics, there is definitely a massive increase taking place. What Islam contends is that this has a direct relationship to the way that the woman is dressed. It has to do with the mentality of the men, etc., etc. But the way that women are dressed does have a major role to play in this process. This is why when Allah instructs the women to wear the outer garment, يُدْنِينَ عَلَيْهِنَّ مِنْ جَلَابِيبِهِنَّ, Allah goes on to say, لِيُعْرَفْنَ وَلَا يُخْذَيْنَ, that they be known and not harmed. So the major goal that Allah has stipulated or pointed out in terms of the veiling of the woman, Muslim woman, is that she not be harmed, that she be known in the society and not be harmed. Because again, some people mistakenly think that, okay, wearing the veil is to become anonymous, meaning that nobody will look at you. No, of course, in this society, for a woman to cover herself up, she's going to be looked at. She's going to draw attention. People will look at her. But the idea is not that they may not be seen, but that they be seen in a particular light. When a person sees a nun walking down the street, people will turn and look. The nun, how she's dressed. And if they see a woman walking down the street, you know, in a bikini, they will turn and look. The woman's walking down the street in a bikini. So in both cases, they are turning to look. But the look is different. There is a difference in the way they're looking in one case and the way they're looking in the other case. And I know personally, when my wife wore hijab and scarf, etc., in Toronto, we used to go on the subway or on the bus. People used to get up out of their seats and offer her you know. Even women would get up and offer her. Some would ask her, you know, what order of nuns she belonged to. But it was obvious that the person dressed in this fashion, you know, was a person who was pious, was religious. I mean, this is what, these are the implications of this dress. You know, that they have a particular outlook on life. They're not about exposing, inviting sexual attraction, etc., etc. So, when they're dressed in this fashion, they are known. They have identified themselves as being a part of a system of belief which does not encourage and, in fact, opposes extramarital relations. Everything else is connected. So one, that they be known. And secondly, as Allah said, that they not be harmed. Because the reality is in the society where everything is sold by way of the female body. You want to sell a Corvette or a Mustang, you know, which is a muscle car, what do? You put a picture of, or a woman in a bikini lying on top of the car. Technically speaking, if you're buying a car, you're supposed to want to know what is your horsepower, you know, what is the speed from 0 to 10 seconds, how fast can it go, and you know, all the different things that are connected with it. But instead, what they want to show you is this woman half naked lying on top of the car. What is the signal? What are they telling you? What are they telling you? If you buy a Mustang, you're going to get what's on top of the car. So, what happens is that in reality, when people go out and they buy their Mustang and they drive around and they don't get what was on top of the car, they're frustrated. And they say, this is supposed to come along with the car. So, you know, in their frustration, then you find them becoming aggressive with regards to women. And this is what is promoting in the society. Society is selling all the different products, whether it is razor blades or whatever. Whatever is being sold in fashion, then it is promoting this idea in the society that the men have this right, that the women are supposed to be falling at their feet. And if they're not, then this promotes an aggression on their part to get what they feel is their right. So, from the Islamic perspective, the veiling is to protect the women from this harm. The veiling, the hijab, doesn't stop with the woman. It also extends to the whole issues of separation, separation in education, separation in the homes, all the different things that have to do, that are interconnected, which are not separate from the veiling in and of itself. So, when we look in the North American context, where we have millions of former American women who grew up with a belief that, or a teaching that, clothing is to expose, to attract, not to cover, not for modesty. There's a whole different philosophy on or behind Western clothing, which is to expose and to attract. This is why you will find in this temperature, you know, 19 degrees below zero, you will still see women out with miniskirts. I mean, you can, obviously, this is not for protection. It's not for protection against the weather, etc. This is to promote the body. So, that philosophy, people, you have millions of women who have grown up with this philosophy, who have accepted Islam and chosen to cover them. This is clear evidence that the covering is not oppression. Of course, Muslim land, where Muslim young women are growing up, and the covering is only cultural. You wear this garment because this is our culture. In our culture, we wear it this way. This is why, for example, in some places, you know, the headscarf just become something worn over the shoulder. It's slipped on a certain on certain occasions, but it's just symbolic. It no longer serves the purpose of what it originally was supposed to serve. The dress, though it may be long and all these things, it becomes form-fitting, you know, showing the body in any case, right? You know, or it may be see-through. So these garments, though originally they were covering type garments, now they have evolved along with Western fashion to become revealing garments. So young women growing up in this context, you know, where the covering, the hijab, they're obliged to wear it because of the cultural pressures, you know, then such people, when they come into North American context and that, you'll find them removing. Because they haven't understood why, or they may express if they're discussing with some feminists or whatever, you know, they may feel this is kind of oppressive. You know, why should we have to wear this? Because the understanding of the principles behind it is not there. It's not taught. This is a mistake in the educational system, that an awareness and an understanding of the principles behind hijab have to be taught, have to be a part of the educational process. With regards to the issue of divorce, which is another area wherein Muslims are usually depicted, you know, as men being able to divorce their women by just saying, "Thou art divorced," three times, and that's it. Divorce is just a very simple procedure from the Islamic perspective, and it's men, they can just say, "You're divorced, you're divorced, you're divorced." It makes marriage seem very trivial in the eyes of Western society. Of course, the process of divorce, we know, is just not that simple. It's not simply a person saying, "You're divorced," three times, and that's divorce. The pronouncement can only take place under certain circumstances. It can only take place if the woman is not in her menses. Right? If the divorce is pronounced whilst the woman is in her menses, then that divorce is not counted. So these are conditions. There are conditions here. It's not just an automatic in the hands of the man in that sense. Secondly, if it's being pronounced in a period between menses, it has to be a period in which no sexual relations have taken place. This is a requirement, another requirement. Meaning that if that person has enough feeling for the woman that he's having this relationship, then divorce is not appropriate. In the previous case, not in her menses, because we know that immediately prior to menses, a woman, or many women, go through certain biological changes, etc., which can affect their thinking patterns, their way of expression, etc., etc., which may be the root cause behind the pronouncement of divorce. So to try to remove that as being one of the factors, Islam prescribes that it does not take place at a time of menses. Furthermore, after the pronouncement, there is a 3 month or three periods of menses have to take place, or 3 months if the woman is not menstruating, or if it's very irregular. There is a waiting period. A waiting period during which the woman is not supposed to be expelled from her home. But again, in the cultures of Muslim people in different places, when a woman is divorced, maybe she automatically leaves her home and goes back to her parents' home. But actually, this is not supposed to be the case. They're supposed to continue to live together to give them an opportunity to work the situation out. So, first and foremost, the divorce is not an automatic. It isn't as complicated maybe as it is in the West, where people, you know, get into divorce court And, you know, everybody starts washing everybody else's laundry in public. You know, he was doing this and that and, you know, all these other kind of things. It becomes very nasty, you know. Okay, in Islam we don't have that. But really, that's not a sense of good anyway. It's harmful. It is relatively simple in the sense that it does start with the pronouncement of divorce. But in another sense, the marriage itself began with a simple acceptance, a proposal and an acceptance, which was pretty simple also. So there's no need to make it, you know, unnecessarily complicated. But at the same time, it is not trivial and easy to the point where it's just three pronouncements and the divorce takes place. The other point is that the idea that the pronouncement of divorce is only in the hands of the man, this is incorrect. This is incorrect. Because, according to Islamic law, if a woman requests at the time of her marriage that it be a condition in her contract of marriage that she also may pronounce the divorce, then she can pronounce it just as the man can, following the same principle. And if at any time in the marriage she asks her husband, "Will you give me the right to pronounce divorce?" and he says, "Okay," she can pronounce it. So it is not limited to the man. It is put initially in the hands of the man, but the woman can also get it through request at any time in the marriage, or putting it in her contract from the very beginning. This is possible. Then, we also have the situation where a woman, as a normal procedure, if she didn't put in the contract, she didn't request it, she can institute divorce proceedings by way of the court, which is known as khula, where she requests, you know, divorce. It goes to the court, wherein the causes, etc., are checked out, etc., you know, to ensure that it isn't over something which can be worked out, something trivial. But it confirms that the woman also has the right to pronounce or to request divorce. Though not exactly the same as the man. True, it's not exactly the same. And this is taken into account the differences in their natures in general. The woman tends to be more highly strung and may react to things more quickly, more easily. So rather than put it in her hand initially, it is put in her hand indirectly. Whereas the man tends to be, you know, more unemotional, not as easily emotionally moved, etc., tends to be more stable in that sense of thinking. It is placed in his hands initially. In terms of the witnesses, and before I go to that, the issue of a woman being married having to have a guardian is an issue that is also raised, where for her marriage to be valid, in the opinion of most of the Muslim scholars, there should be a male guardian, his consent should be given. This is primarily to protect the interests of the woman. It is not primarily to oppress the woman, though Muslims may use it in this way, where women are not allowed to marry the people of their choice. Okay, that is Muslim. But according to Islamic law, the principle is to protect the interests of the woman. Why? Because a woman who tends to judge things more emotionally can be fooled by a man. If it's just left up to her accepting this man or not, he can create an image, you know, of being this or being that, being very kind, being very, you know, he has this false face that he presents, which is attractive to the woman, but the real individual is somebody else. So by having a guardian, the job of the guardian is to check this person out. Check the people who know him under other circumstances, check the family situation, etc., to get a clear picture of who this person is. To ensure that the daughter or the sister or the mother or whoever is marrying somebody genuine who will, in fact, take care of her property. So the issue of guardianship is for the protection of the woman, not to force her into marriages that she doesn't wish to be involved in. In terms, back up to the divorce, the common practice of pronouncing three divorces, which according to the Prophet is equivalent only to one, where in cultural Muslim circumstances, this issue of just pronouncing the divorce three times and just getting rid of the woman, this is the practice. This is the common practice. But as we said, that is the culture of people today, not Islamic teachings per se. Now, the two witnesses, the issue of two witnesses being equal to a male witness. Now, this is something which is stated in the Quran, that when one is writing contracts, one should have two witnesses. Two males, or a male and two females. Allah goes on to say that so that one of the women may remind the other in case they forgot. Okay? Allah explains, what is the purpose here? To remind. Why? Okay? In a society where women are pushed out into the workplace and have to deal and survive the same way men do, such a woman would want to question, why? I can know about business just the same way a man does. Why do I need anybody to remind me? Yeah. In this abnormal situation, the woman being pushed out into the workplace, her familiarity with contracts and these type of things may be, in a lot of cases, quite the same as that of men. But the norm in the world as a whole is that the men are the ones who are out of the home dealing with the contracts and these type of things, who are familiar with what is involved in contracts and tend to be better able to remember the terms of contracts, etc., etc. Whereas women tend to be in the home more in taking care of the home situation, raising the children, etc., etc. This is the norm. This has been the norm from the most ancient periods of history. It is only recently, in the last 100 years, that women have been pushed out into the workforce on a scale, unknown in previous history. So, the Islamic principle there is for the norm of human society, the norm of what would be in Muslim society, where though women may work, not to say women are prevented from working, most of the work would be outside of the home, would be carried on by the males in society. And to clarify that this is really restricted to particular areas. In a case where a woman has breastfed a man and his wife, her statement that she has breastfed the man and his wife is enough to annul that marriage. It happened in the time of the Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. One of the companions came to the Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam and asked him, this woman came to us and told us that, she breastfed both of us. She was a former slave or whatever, he felt she was like insignificant in society. Should I take her word? Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam said, it was said. Once that has been stated, and the circumstances obviously support it, it doesn't mean somebody flies from China, comes to visit you in Montreal and tells you this, you're going to say, oh yeah? No. I mean, there are circumstances here which could support, yes, this person was around, they were known, so and so, yes, quite possible if this took place. once that is stated, a single witness of a woman on this part is sufficient to nullify that marriage. So it is not across the board. It's not across the board that you need two witnesses, you know, females for a male. Or for example, there's a case of adultery or fornication. Yeah? Adultery or fornication. I mean, it says basically to apply the law you require four witnesses. These don't have to be four males. I mean, if four women saw, you know, people involved in fornication or adultery, I mean, nobody needs to remind each other about what they saw. I mean, what they saw with their own eyes, is nobody has any problem remembering that, right? So in cases where, I mean, of this nature, the witness of the woman's single witness in this out of one out of four is sufficient. So it's not just across the board. The other area, which is also raised by feminists, is the area concerning inheritance. Because we know it states in the Quran that for the male, there is twice the portion of the female. لِلْذَكَرِ حَظِّ الْأُنْثَيَيْنِ. That's what it states. The children. However, this has to be looked at, as we said again, in the context of the Islamic society. In the context of the Islamic society, a woman, as a daughter, as a sister, as a mother, as a wife, as a grandmother, all of the circumstances that she may exist in society, there are males who are held responsible to look after her. There are males who it's their responsibility to take care of her. It's not like Western society where a woman, you know, she falls onto welfare and so on. Islamic society, there will be some welfare system there to look after people who have no one to look after them. But this means that they have no relatives, no male relatives, so who can take care of them. In that circumstance, then the state steps in and takes care of them. Otherwise, such people are taken care of by the family. The family provides a system of looking after those who are weak or helpless or whatever in the society. That is their responsibility. So the woman, in all of the various positions that she may appear in the society, has males who are responsible for her being taken care of. So consequently, when money is being divided, some money goes to her, which is her own right to do with as she pleases, as some money should go to her brother, which is his own right to do with as he pleases, but then an additional amount is given to the brother, who is also responsible to take care of the sister. That additional amount is based on his responsibility with regards to his sister or his mother, etc., etc. And we know also that this is not just right across the board in all circumstances. Because in the same chapter, the fourth chapter of the Quran, where the inheritance laws are discussed, in verse 11, we have Allah saying, for each parent is one-sixth if the deceased left children. So, the division where there are children and their responsibility now has been given to some of the children to look after the others, then the parent's division becomes equal. We also find if a man or woman left neither descendants or ascendants, but left a brother or a sister, each gets one-sixth. If there are more than two, they equally share one-third. So there are other of the, you know, away from the immediate inheritors who will have their divisions taken place on an equal basis. Wherein, for example, there are other family members around who would look after the females in that circumstance. So, we know that it is not just across the board. In all cases, it's 2-1. No. It is primarily for children, yes. But outside of the area of the children, it ends up, in the case of parents, brothers, sisters, etc., they end up dividing on an equal basis. The other area is concerning women again, is the area in modern times, that area concerning abortion. The right of the woman to decide what happens to her body. Right? She has a child in her womb, she wants to abort this child. The argument today is her body, she can do, you know, with her body, this is her right to be able to do with her body as she pleases. Islamic law says no. Yes, it is your body, but the child that is inside your body is not you. It's not the same as your arm or your leg or your hair. You know, something which is growing from your body, you want to cut your hair, nobody can say, okay, don't cut your hair. Of course, again, Muslim culture says women should not cut their hair. This is culture. Islamic teachings permit women to cut their hair. Only that should not cut it in the styles of nails, where they look masculine, etc. Now, so what we're talking about here is that the embryo growing inside of the woman is not like her hair. She wants to cut it, she doesn't want to cut it, right? Or any other part of her body, which is hers. The embryo growing inside of her body, it doesn't even share the same blood. That embryo, that child that is born, can have a different blood type from the mother altogether. Why? Because, you know, in common understanding, you know, masses of people think that it's the blood of the woman, her blood vessels actually go into the child, and the child is being fed directly by these blood. This is not the case. Her blood vessels pass by this membrane. This is where the placenta plays a particular role in carrying the nutrients. The blood vessels of the child is inside the placenta. The placenta is embedded in the womb, the walls of the womb, and food is transferred across the membranes that separate the placenta from the wall of the womb. So the blood of the woman does not enter into the child, nor does the blood of the child enter into the woman. So that child is a separate entity within her. And this is why we as Muslims, we say that we uphold the rights of women more than Western society, which claims to be, you know, liberationist, freedom of women, etc., etc. Because we, that child is a girl, we say you cannot kill that child. In the West, where they're wanting to fight for women's rights, all these type of things, they give the woman the right to kill the child. So the child, as the female, can be killed. Where is the right being protected here? That child is being killed. And what happens is in society, places like China and India, where issues of overpopulation, you know, on one hand in China, which has led the government to restrict children to one per couple, right? So the Chinese couple know they can only have one child. They all want a male, because the male will provide strength to the family, he can get out in the fields, he can, you know, so they want male. So what happens is, they get an ultrasound, when the woman is pregnant, they're able to determine this is a girl, they abort the girl. So there is a change in the population, you know, dynamics there in China over the last, you know, 20, 30 odd years. Major change has been taking place. The number of men are now, you know, more than the women in that society. This is something abnormal. Go around the rest of the world, the women outnumber the men. Under normal circumstances, women will outnumber men. Biological reasons, etc. They live longer, etc. But in China and in India, again, where a woman is a curse for a family, because you have a female, now to get her married, you're going to have to pay all this money, so she's a burden. Whereas if you have a male, he's going to bring in money. Right? So, again, it's very common in India amongst the Hindus that, you know, midwives whether or not they don't have money to do ultrasound, midwives are paid so much to deliver the child and paid an extra amount to kill the female children. And there's been in the newspapers, there's, you know, exposés where they've talked about it. Midwives are practicing and doing it. They will strangle the child or whatever, cause the child to die at birth. They paid an extra for that. And of course, those who can afford the ultrasound, etc., etc., then their ultrasound determining the girl and aborting them. So female children are being killed in mass in China and India. Islam prohibits it. So we can say, Islamically speaking, we protect the rights of the women more so than these other societies which allow abortion. Islam prohibits the woman from aborting the child. Yes, according to Islamic law, a fetus, an embryo, is not considered to be a human being until the beginning of the fifth month. So abortion, which takes place before the fifth month, would not be considered the taking of a human life. However, according to Islamic law, it is prohibited to take any life without just cause. Prophet Muhammad said that we should not take birds as our target, animals in general, as our target. You know, you bought a new hunting rifle, you know, you go out in the wild there and you start shooting birds, shooting squirrels, whatever, you know, checking your sights. No, it's not allowed in Islam to make animals your target just for fun, for practice, or whatever. It's forbidden. The whole mentality which produced the safari mentality, where Westerners used to go into Africa and places like this, you know, in India, you know, go off and kill them stuff, an elephant or a rhino or something, to get a picture of themselves, you know, 1 foot on the dead animal and gun in the hand, you know, photograph you put on, you know, above your fireplace, you cut off its foot or its horn or something and you stick it again on the wall someplace. You know, this kind of mentality where animals are, you know, killed for sport, this is forbidden in Islam. We are only allowed to kill animals, one, if they're dangerous to us, if they're life-threatening, two, if we're killing them for food, or three, if we're killing them for need, clothing. Right? We don't agree with the people who say, no, you can't use furs and all this stuff. Of course, the method that these people are using to kill the animals, you know, they show how they kill these otters and the the minks and the others, you know, where they take clubs and they batter them, and of course, this is horrible. Islam doesn't support that at all. Right? But to kill the animal out of human need, yes, human need is given precedence also and over animal life. We kill them for a need, not just for sport. And, of course, the issues of killing animals, you know, we have, what's her name there in France, what's her name?
Brigitte Bardot,
yes, you know, campaigning against Muslims, these bestial Muslims killing sheep, and you know, every Eid al-Adha comes along, they're killing all these sheep, you know, she's protecting animal rights, and she got fined for maligning Muslims over these issues. But studies have shown that the humane methods of the Westerners, right, where they get a stun gun, right, they have a gun which has a piston in it, right, and they put a bullet without just the casing, so the powder will explode, then it fires out this piston, smashes the animal in the head, knocks it unconscious, then they string it up and they cut the neck, and they say, this is humane, right? Not like the Muslims, we cut the neck while the animal is alive. This is their argument. But common sense. I mean, of course, nobody can go into an animal's head and ask him, is it hurt more to get your head knocked in and get your neck cut, or just cut your neck? You know, we can't ask them, they can't tell us. So we have to use our own common sense in the sense of our nervous systems are such a similar. Now, if somebody comes and slugs you in the head enough to knock you out, is this painful or isn't it painful? You know, I mean, nobody has to, you know, make any special studies to determine how painful it is, you know, getting punched in the head and knocked out. And practically speaking, we know if you have a very sharp knife, a razor blade or something like this, you can run your hand on it, cut yourself, and not even be bleeding, and you don't even realize you're cutting until you see blood dripping, you know, someplace. So it's very clear that a very sharp knife cutting, it will cut without you feeling it, without you realizing it, without you knowing it. One of the popular ways of suicide is what? You go into a nice warm bath, right, and you take out your razor blades, you cut your wrists, and you know, pass away. Why do people choose it? Right? Those who don't like the sight of blood, okay, they can't do it. But those who don't mind, you know, they choose this. Why? Because you go away in a very nice and gradual kind of, you know, without pain. So we can say from practical human experience, etc., it's very clear that to slaughter an animal by sharpening the knife, very sharp knife,